bring the message that God has laid on my heart. If you have your Bible, would you please turn to the book of Genesis, chapter 22. Genesis, chapter 22. And our text tonight begins in verse 1 and continues through verse 14. Genesis, chapter 22, beginning in verse 1. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you." Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. Verse 4. On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, "Father." "Yes, my son." "The fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Abraham answered, "God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son," and the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." There are moments in time when something that is so outrageous that we're capable of missing it. There are just moments in a narrative when you come across something and it is just ridiculous, and yet sometimes you can miss it and treat it as if it's just a casual thing. I heard a story once about a man who was out driving way out in a rural part of the world, just enjoying a beautiful day, driving along, and all of a sudden his car started to make a funny noise, and he barely got it off to the side of the road before it just completely died. He didn't know a lot about cars, but he got out and he popped the hood and he was just sort of taking it all in, looking at it, and he heard a voice say, "It's the transmission." And he stepped back from the car and he looked around and he could not see anywhere one human being. And so he went back to work, not sure what he had just heard, and he was looking and pulling on wires and just tugging things, hoping to make something go, and he heard the voice again and it said, "It's the transmission." Now, a second time he had heard the voice, and this time he stepped away from the car and he did a 360. He looked all around, and the only thing that he saw standing right there by the side of the road behind a fence was an old plow horse. Had a straw hat on, had a, you know, sunken back, swished tail that was swishing flies away. And now he's spooked because there's no other human beings around, and so he got so scared he just took off. He just took off half running, half walking down the road, and he didn't stop until he found a farmer who was out working in his field right next to the road. And he stopped and he said, "The strangest thing just happened to me." He said, "A couple miles back, my car just died and I was able to get it off to the side of the road." And he said, "I was looking under the hood and I heard a voice say, 'It's your transmission.'" And he said, "It happened twice." And he said, The first time I went back to work because I didn't really think that much of it, but the second time I stepped back and the only thing that I could see was an old plow horse standing by the side of the road. And the farmer said, did this plow horse have an old straw hat that somebody had put on his head? Yeah. And was his back kind of sunken like old horses do? He goes, yeah. And he said, and was he kind of swishing flies away with his tail? And the man said, that's it. And the farmer said, listen, don't you pay any mind to that horse at all. He doesn't know anything about transmissions. You know, a talking horse is a big deal. But in that story, it was treated as if somehow it was normal, but it was not. In the story that we just read a moment ago, there is something that is outrageous. To any normal human mind, it is so off the charts outrageous that it can hardly be digested by our mind. Because in the story that we just read, in Genesis chapter 22, the God of the universe says to one of his created beings, Abraham, I want you to murder your son. And you know, being a Christian, growing up in church, going to Sunday school, we've heard this story so much that it's almost as if we're no longer shocked by that fact. Because we know how it all plays out. And when you know how a story plays out, sometimes you can lose some of the drama that's in it. But it's amazing to me that the God who created everything audibly speaks to Abraham and gives him this instruction. Your son, the one I am responsible for, the one I gave you, I want you to put him to death. We're almost forced to ask the question, who does God think he is? That he would do something like that. I mean, how presumptuous is it for God to give an instruction like that about having a father take the life of his son? But you know, we see a glimpse of that same attitude in the New Testament. Now, a few years ago, I had the opportunity to actually visit the site of the temple in Jerusalem. Stood at the Wailing Wall, put my hand on the Wailing Wall. It was an incredible experience. That's really the only part of the temple that is still in existence. From what I read, everything about the temple was designed to keep you in your place. There was an area in the temple where if you were a woman, you could come and you could worship God. But there was a line. And if you crossed that line, you did so taking your life into your hands. You could be killed. There was an area beyond that where if you were a Gentile, you could come to the temple and you could worship. There was an area for Gentiles to be able to come to the temple and worship. But there was a line. And if you as a Gentile stepped over that line out of the little area that was designated for you, you could be executed for that. Beyond that was an area where if you were a member of the priestly class, if you were a Levite, you could come and worship. But there was a clearly delineated line that you could not cross unless you were the high priest. And then only one day a year was the high priest allowed to enter into that territory called the Holy of Holies to present a sacrifice, a blood offering. Everything about the temple was designed to let you know you better stay in your place. But in the Gospel of John, chapter 2, Jesus comes into the temple and acts like he owns the place. And for the religious leaders and the Pharisees, the presumption of authority, by the way, that's the question they ask him, by what authority do you do this? It's in John chapter 2. By what authority do you do this? You are way out of line, fella. You have no right. And this is what Jesus told them. I have every right. This is my Father's house. And he said, I'll tell you how much right I have. This place that you adore is going to come crashing down. and there will not be one stone left on top of another. And a few years later, the Romans came and they did exactly that. And they took it apart piece by piece by piece. But the question that lingered is, who gives you the right to be able to do that? It's the question that I think Abraham might have asked. What gives you the right? By the way, it's not the first time that God intervened in Abraham's life and gave him this type of instruction. If you go back to the book of Genesis, you will see that in Genesis 12, the same God said to Abraham, I want you to pack up and leave your home territory, the only home that you have ever known, and go to a place and I'll show you. He didn't even give him a zip code, no address. I'll just show you. And then a little bit later on in Genesis chapter 13, God said to Abraham, don't trust your eyes when you're looking over the land. Trust me. Don't believe what appears in your mind and in your eyes to be the quality land. I want you to trust me. And so Abraham let Lot go first, and Lot fell for the grassy area. It turned out to be in the wrong direction, and he ended up in Sodom. And if that's not enough, in Genesis chapter 15, God says to Abraham, trust me, I'm going to give you a son. And Abraham's like, my wife is way beyond the time in life when you give birth to children. And God said, trust me, I will do this. God seems to feel that he can enter into this man's life at any point in time, at any season in time, and tell him to do things that are outrageous. It was outrageous to pack up and leave your home territory. That was his home. That was his heritage. It was outrageous for him to say, don't trust your eyes. If a salesman came to your house today and said, hey, I'm going to tell you something, but you got to not trust your own eyes, trust me, you'd throw them out. And if someone came up to you today and said, I know that you're in your 90s, but you're going to have a child. Yeah, right. And yet God seems to swing into Abraham's life in many different occasions. So when we come to Genesis chapter 22, this is an active narrative. This is not the first time that God has been working in Abram's life to give him these kind of instructions. There's a pattern of outrageous commands that do not make sense to the natural mind. And at first, they almost sound horrible. Not just outrageous, they almost sound horrible. A couple of reasons to underscore how outrageous it is. Listen, God's statement emphasizes that Isaac was his only son. That's not an accident. That's in there on purpose. Your son, your only son. The firstborn was special. The firstborn had the opportunity to do things that any other child in the family could never experience. Your son, your only son. The second thing that God says is, observe, he says, the one you love. Would you believe me if I told you that that's the first time that that word is ever used in Scripture in Genesis 22? The one you love. God is not helping his cause. I want you to sacrifice your son, you know, your fourthborn, the one that you've never really cared for. No, that's not what he's saying. He's saying, this is the special son. This is the firstborn. This is the one that you waited 24 years for. The one you love. And then also, please notice that it's exactly the same word that God used in chapter 12 when he said, I will show you. He says, I'll show you. God comes in and gives this directive to Abraham. This is what I want you to do. And we need to agree, or this doesn't make any sense at all, that this is an outrageous request, an outrageous command. It just doesn't land. Jack Smith, who for many years was a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, wrote about this passage, I would have told God, mind your own business. Now that's blunt, But I can relate. I have three sons, and if God spoke to me and said, I want you to execute one of them, I don't think I'd say, yippee. You can't mean it, God. You obviously don't understand how precious this is. You obviously can't relate to what I'm feeling when you give me this command to take my son, my only son, the one whom I love, and just follow you blindly and offer him on an altar as a sacrifice. God, am I hearing you correctly? This cannot be right. And God doesn't back away for 1 minute. He doesn't apologize. He doesn't say, let me explain. He just says, here's my command. Verse 3. The passage says, early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded the donkey. Basically, he's packing the car. Now, I missed this in this passage for many years. I taught this for many years, and I missed this because it says, the next morning, Abraham got up. And I guess for many years, I was just complimenting him on what tremendous obedience this was. If I get this command from the Lord and the next morning I need to do this, I'm going to hit the snooze button 8, 9, 10 times. I don't want to get up. Any excuse that I can find to not get up, I'm not going to get up. Instead, verse 3 says, early the next morning, Abraham got up. And I was reading something by Soren Kierkegaard. And he said, is it possible that the reason that Abraham got up so early is that he didn't sleep a wink that night? If you were wrestling with that command, would you sleep soundly, knowing what the next day was going to bring? Perhaps we make Abraham out to be more holy than he really is. He has been given a command that is crushing in its weight. What would you do? What would you do if God spoke to you tonight and said, your home, the place that you've lived maybe for 20 or 30 or 40 years, your home, which maybe you just got paid off, I want you to give it to me. I just want you to hand the deed over to me. What would he say to you? Would he say, your children, your son, your daughter, I want you to release them to me. No questions asked. I want you to give them to me. Your bank account. Everything that you've invested. Everything that you've saved. Everything that you've put away for retirement. I want it. Your job. The one that you are really good at and that you are highly respected in. The one that brings you tremendous income but also tremendous emotional reward. I want it. I want you to step away from it. Your dream, that thing that you have always wanted. For many, many years, you have wished for and worked for and prayed for that thing that you desire, that thing that you reach for, that vision of what the future would look like if it were just perfect. What would you say if God came to you and said, I want you to put that on the altar tonight? I want you to surrender that which is precious to you, that which cannot be adequately summed up in value. I want you to give that to me. I was watching the news a few months back, and there was a family in Texas, and the flood had come, and it had wiped their home completely away. Every material possession that they had was gone, but they found their daughter clinging to a tree a couple of miles downstream. And that family looked into the lens of the news camera and said, we're fine. Because what really mattered to them was still theirs. And what mattered but not so much, they were okay with that being gone. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm talking to you tonight about the one clinging to the tree, not to the house. What would you do if God came to you and said, that, I put my finger on that, that's what I want from you? Verse 4, On the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servant, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then come back to you. Some commentators say, see, Abraham believed that his son was going to be resurrected. What? I don't know. What else is he going to say? I'm going to go murder my son. I don't think they would have let him do it. And Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, in verse 7, it is Isaac who speaks up and says to his father, hey, father? Yes. We see fire, we see wood. Where is the lamb? It's Isaac who speaks up and has a question. Understandable. It's his life that's about to be sacrificed. Isaac says, excuse me, can I just ask one question? What's going on here? I love the fact that the Bible doesn't paint over the humanness of its characters. Isaac is maybe getting a little sweaty, a little anxious. It seems like we're headed to a sacrifice, but the sacrifice itself doesn't seem to be present. And so he says to his father, what's going on? When God puts his finger on that precious thing and says, I want it, he is not needing to give me an explanation. He doesn't owe me that. He is God, I am not. And he thinks that he has every right to put his finger on that which is most precious to me and ask me to give it to him. And my human reaction is no, because it would mean loss. It would mean I would be lesser. It would mean the world would be lesser. It would mean that my pain would be unbearable. It would mean that somehow my life would go from being a great life to being an awful life. And every fiber of my being would react and say, no. But Abraham was a man who knew God. And in verse 9, he says, Isaac, I don't understand, but this I do know. God's going to provide. God is going to provide. Verse 8, Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And the two of them went on together. Later on, we're going to be told that the name of that place became known as God will provide. When God calls me to make that sacrifice of that which is precious to me that I can't even comprehend doing without, when he calls me to surrender my dream, my vision, my goal, when he calls me to give out of what I think I cannot possibly separate myself from, his only answer to me is this, I will provide. He says to me, make that sacrifice and your life will still be better than ever. I confess there are days that I do not understand that, but I don't need to. I just need to know that God said it. We kick the word faith around a lot in the evangelical world, but faith is really what happens when God says, I want that which matters most to you. And I say, God, I don't understand why you're asking me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I say, yes. And Abraham said, yes. And when they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And in verse 10, as we're reaching the climax, he reaches out his hand and he took the knife to slay his son. And the angel cries out, Abraham, Abraham, no, do not touch your son. You see, what God wanted to do was not build Abraham's faith. This is not a faith-building exercise. What God wanted to do was reveal Abraham's faith. You know, I used to love, when I was in college, I used to love to sit under some of my professors who were teaching theology, and I would just drink in everything that they were teaching, and I would take notes, and it was just a wonderful experience. I was learning so much. But every couple of weeks, they would stand up in front of the class, and they would say something that would make my blood run cold. They would say, "It's time for a test." And those I could have done without. Never did well on the test. At Tocoa, we had a wall outside of the theology department, a bulletin board, and they had, and every student had a code number. Mine was 330. I'll never forget my code number. And so anytime that you took a test, your name was never listed, but your code number was listed, and you would go to the theology department, and you would go to that wall, and you would stand, and you would look for 330, and when you came to it, it revealed how well you had done or how well you had not done. And the name of that wall was called the Wailing Wall, and you can understand why. Abraham is being tested. He's known God. He's walked with God. This is the test. And as he lifts the knife, God says, "Stop. I never had any intention of having Isaac lose his life. I just wanted to know, is there anything that you're holding back from me? Is there anything that you don't trust me with?" You know, there are times that we talk about surrendering to God, and what we're really saying is it's the broken things of our lives, the junk, the sin, the mess that we've made of our lives. And we say, just bring it to God. And that's absolutely true. Nothing wrong with that. I think sometimes we neglect to talk about giving God the good things, the precious things, the valuable things, the things that aren't necessarily broken, the things that we would have a tendency to cling to. God wants those too. And he thinks like he deserves them. God didn't want Isaac, God wanted Abraham. And he wanted his all. That's what he wanted. And he thinks that he has every right to ask for all. Not just the broken parts, but the precious things too. Not just the things that I detest and I want to get rid of. I just need to give that to the Lord, the problems of life. No, he wants what I cherish. And here's why. Many years after this event in Genesis 22, believe it or not, on that same piece of property, on that Mount Moriah, God the Father put his son on the altar. And there was no one there to say, "Don't touch him, don't do it." And God sacrificed his own son, that which was indescribably precious to him, on that hill that we sometimes refer to as Calvary. That same spot. And it is because of that event. It is because of what God the Father did that day outside the city of Jerusalem that he believes that he has every right to step into your life and ask you to give him your all. One day Jesus was speaking to the disciples and he said, "This is God's plan for me. I'm going to go to Jerusalem. I'm going to be arrested. I'm going to be tried. I'm going to be beaten. I'm going to be crucified. And I'm going to be put in the tomb, and 3 days later, I'm going to rise from the dead." And Peter, ever the spokesman, spoke up and said, "No, may it never be so." Peter could not comprehend that degree of sacrifice. Peter believed, he had made it clear at Caesarea Philippi, he believed that Jesus was the Son of God. He could not comprehend that the Son of God would lose his life. And Jesus turned to him and said, "Peter, you're not thinking the way I think. You're actually thinking the way Satan thinks." If we believe that we are exempt from the call of God on the precious things in our lives, the things that matter so much to us, we're not thinking the way God thinks. Because God has made us a promise, and that promise is, you put that thing, whatever it may be, on the altar, and I will provide for you. That is not a promise that He made once and done to Abraham many years ago. That is a promise that He makes to you tonight. He invites you to bring to Him that which means most to you, whatever it may be, confident that if you do so, you will not walk away with less, but actually with more. That's His promise tonight. Does it sound outrageous? It is, until you understand Calvary. So my invitation to you tonight is very simple, but it is very sincere. What is it in your life that even as Holy Spirit has been speaking to you tonight, He has identified as that which matters most to you? And are you willing to bring it to an altar and present it to Jesus? You say, I don't understand why He wants that. You don't have to. But if you're hearing His voice say, this is it, maybe you have never fully surrendered your children. You know, there are many, many missionaries who never got there because their parents never blessed God's call on their life. I don't want my grandchildren being raised 10,000 miles from me. So you've never put them on the altar. Maybe God has given you gifts, spiritual gifts, talents, abilities, financial resources, but you've always had your hands on it. You've controlled it. Maybe some of you have never surrendered your church to Jesus. It's His church. And yet I deal with leadership teams all the time, and one of the tendencies is to refer to it as our church. And when it's our church, I'm in control. And Jesus says, can you trust me with my church to just surrender it back to me and let me be Lord of my own church? Can you do that? Whatever it is, if it's precious to you, Jesus is saying to you tonight, I want it. Can you believe me? Can you take me at my word that if you follow me in that faith, that I will not disappoint you? And you're going to be better off surrendering it to me than trying to hold on to it. Because Jesus said, the one who tries to hold on to his life will lose it. The one who gives it away, that's the one who's really found it. It's the same principle we're talking about tonight. As the team comes to lead us in a closing song, you know what you do with that which you're offering to God? You bring it to an altar. And for some of you, maybe coming to an altar is scary. Maybe it's not part of your worship tradition. But tonight, I'm going to be bold and invite you to respond by physically making a trip to the altar. If the altar fills, there are chairs in the front, and do some business with God. I don't know that you need anybody else with you. If you want someone to pray with you, just make it be known. And there are many people here that will pray with you. This is an intensely individual moment, you and God. I don't need to know what you're offering. No one else needs to know, but you need to know that this is what I'm offering to God tonight, that which is the most precious, valuable thing in my life that I can't imagine parting with. What's your Isaac tonight that you need to bring and turn over to Him? As we stand and we sing, would you come and obey God? Something completely unexpected popped up. Your provision. Didn't see it coming. Where's the sacrifice? If Isaac's not it, where is it? You said, I'll take care of it. And out of nowhere, a ram caught in a thicket became the sacrifice. Lord, when we don't release things to you, we treat you as if you are weak and powerless. But when we surrender things to you, we say, my God is big enough that he's going to take care of me. And if it's painful, he'll be there on the other side of the pain. Lord, for those who are here, I pray for that sweet release, holding nothing back. For those who are not here, but they are wrestling tonight, they've heard your voice, and they're just not at the point yet where they're ready. Lord, don't forget them. They need you to give them confidence in you that it will work. Lord, there's no telling what you will do if we just give ourselves to you. As we close this night, please go quietly. Take your conversations outside of the building if you please can. Keep this a place of reverence and prayer. There are people here doing very important business with God, and I do not want to disturb them at all. Enjoy the cool of the evening wherever you can find it. You're dismissed. Go in peace. God bless you.